But of course, kind of blew me off my feet, and I got up after I'd been hit, and I was just kind of off adrenaline. I got up and ran.
An Anchorage man was injured in the Reno Air Show crash. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 19th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, can South Central residents conserve energy when it really counts?
It's really important to prove that conservation can get us through a low spell in the gas supply.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
The Environmental Protection Agency has approved air quality permits for a Shell oil drilling vessel and accompanying vessels that the company hopes to use in Arctic waters next year. The EPA on Monday approved the air permits for the drilling vessel Noble Discoverer. The permits are a key hurdle for Shell to overcome before it can begin exploratory drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas off Alaska's northwest coast. Environmental groups and some Alaska Native groups oppose offshore drilling. Drilling was held up this year in part by a successful appeal of two air permits EPA issued to Shell in 2010. An Alaska man who was injured at the National Championship Air Races and Air Show in Reno, Nevada, is recovering. Noah Jorenstad is a pilot for Penn Air. He lives in Anchorage and normally flies routes for Penn Air around western and southwestern Alaska. But on Friday, he was in the VIP seating at the Reno Air Show where the crash happened.
I saw the airplane go up in the air and come down, and I knew it was going to hit where I was sitting, so I got up and ran. And then the force kind of blew me off my feet, and I got up after I'd been hit, and I was just kind of off adrenaline. I got up and ran, and then I kind of collapsed. I was laying there, and a lot of spectators came forward. I was able to make a couple phone calls because I didn't know the extent of my injuries. I didn't know, you know, if I was going to die or be paralyzed, so I made some calls while I was getting loaded on the ambulance.
Jorenstad was taken to Northern Nevada Medical Center, where he spent the past few days getting shrapnel removed from a wound in his back. The injury barely missed his vital organs and spine. He also sustained a head injury, requiring 9 stitches. Jorenstad characterizes his injuries as moderate, and doctors say he should be back on his feet in just a few weeks. Reflecting on the cause of the crash, Jorenstad says as a pilot, he knew right away it was a mechanical failure.
I think there was some sort of mechanical failure with the airplane because, you know, if the pilot was flying it, he would have got it, you know, he would have tried to aim it away from people. And I just feel that something broke because of how violent it pulled up and how it rolled over. It told me something was broken. And that's why one of the reasons I started running so fast, because I knew it was out of control and it was going to crash.
Jorenstad has been a pilot for Penn Air for 4 years. He hopes to be back at work in 6 to 8 weeks. Around 70 people were injured and 10 people were killed as a result of the Reno Air Show crash on Friday. An Australian company wants to explore deep coal resources in Alaska. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the proposal is aimed at coal too far underground to mine.
Brisbane-based Link Energy has applied for permits to explore underground coal seams near Healy and at Beluga on Cook Inlet. Russell Kirkham, coal program manager for the State Department of Natural Resources, says Link has proposed exploratory drilling projects.
They're looking to drill down about 4,000 feet to look for the potential for deep-seated coal seams that may have potential for in-situ gasification.
That's a way of developing deep coal beds inaccessible by conventional mining. It's not new technology. Kirkham says the over 100-year-old concept involves burning coal underground and piping the produced gases to the surface.
The byproduct is a scent gas consisting of hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and other gases. That gas can be used to run power generation, or it can be uplifted into a fuel. So you need to do synthetic fuel such as diesel and jet fuel.
The process has been tested and used on a limited basis in several places around the world, including Russia, China, South Africa, and Uzbekistan, where it's fired a power plant for over 50 years. Link Energy is pursuing test projects in Australia and exploration in Wyoming and Montana's Powder River Basin, as well as in Alaska. Cook Inlet Region Incorporated is beginning its own exploratory program on native land west of Anchorage. The process is considered better than conventional coal mining and burning in that fewer toxins and emissions are released to the surface, but the state's Kirkham says there are environmental issues.
The biggest concerns we're looking at is to make sure that the groundwater resources are protected and that the surface environment is protected. So we don't want to have any kind of releases of hydrocarbons or other contaminants into the drinking water supply or the shallow aquifers.
Also at issue is surface subsidence caused by the underground void left behind from burned coal and the potential for releases of large volumes of atmospheric warming CO2. The reinjection of CO2 underground is one solution for handling the vast amount of greenhouse gas produced. Public comments being taken by the state on Link Energy's exploratory drilling proposals for Healy and Beluga through September 30th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Naknek Electric Association has released a plan explaining where they're going to with their geothermal project. The member-owned electricity cooperative filed for bankruptcy last year after problems with the more than decade-old geothermal exploration. KDLG's Daisha Eaton reports.
Naknek Electric Association has released their plan of reorganization. The company provides electricity for Naknek King Salmon by burning diesel. Naknek Electric filed for bankruptcy last year after problems with a geothermal exploration sent them into the red. The disclosure statement of their plan of reorganization outlines how the company plans to move forward. Donna Vukic is the general manager of Naknek Electric Association. She says two things sent the company into Chapter 11: excessive borrowing because of skyrocketing fuel costs.
We used to purchase our diesel out of pocket, out of our own cash flow. And about 2005, 2006 time zone, the price got too high to do that. And we were borrowing a couple million dollars. And then in 2008, it jumped up and we had to borrow $6 million.
Then problems with their geothermal development project caused delays in funding from the U.S. Department of Energy. The drilling fluid, made of a barium derivative, ended up plugging up fractures in the geothermal well needed to access the geothermal energy. Naknek Electric has been trying to figure out a way to unplug the fractures, but hasn't found one. Meantime, the rules for the DOE grants were changed, and Naknek Electric is trying to get back into compliance so they can access those millions of dollars in grant monies. Naknek Electric filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in September 2010, and has been working on the plan of reorganization since. Although the company is still pursuing the geothermal project, under the new plan, they'll just produce electricity by burning diesel.
It's a diesel-only plan with a small part in there written about Department of Energy, which could make changes in it. It's a five-year plan. We would pay back about 10 cents on a dollar to our creditors. In 5 years, we'd pay approximately $3 million. And we hope not to raise any rates on the members, that we will hold our costs down so that we can get that paid without further impacting the membership.
Under the plan, the geothermal well could be plugged, abandoned, and sold off if Naknek Electric does not get funding through the Department of Energy, with the money used to pay back their creditors. Vukic estimates that Naknek Electric owes approximately $47 million to creditors. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an historic roadhouse gets a facelift.
They've nicknamed this corridor as the Adventure Corridor because there's such access to the mountains, the Wrangell St. Elias, or people are traveling more and more there. They're wanting more of real Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission has dismissed a complaint over a ballot initiative aimed at the Pebble Mine project. Alaskans for Bristol Bay alleged that opponents of the Save Our Salmon ballot initiative were distributing flyers at a school. The complainant accused Lake and Peninsula Borough Mayor Glenn Allsworth, Matthew Nicolai, and native actor Wes Studi of distributing political flyers to students. The school principal and superintendent state that this never happened, and APOC quickly dismissed the complaint. Lake and Peninsula Superintendent Ty May says it appears the flyers were posted on a public bulletin board by students without approval. The measure will be voted on October 4th. If passed, it would give the borough authority to bar large-scale mining activities that could significantly impact salmon streams. South Central Alaska may be enjoying a mild fall, but three regional mayors are looking toward winter. In particular, they're concerned about the public knowing how to respond should natural gas supplies be interrupted during a cold spell. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
At a Monday morning press conference, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan made what has now become a familiar autumn message.
We're asking everybody once again to participate in a test. This conservation test will be Wednesday, October 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. And we'll ask the citizens to literally turn it off, power it down, and generally try and reduce the amount of energy they normally use.
Sullivan was flanked by Matanuska, Susitna Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss, and Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Dave Carey. The Anchorage mayor explained the reason behind the two-hour power consumption reduction.
We've been working with our partners for 3 years now in the Matsu and the Kenai Peninsula to inform the public about what they might be called to do on a dark and cold winter night if natural gas pressure falls to the point where deliverability is in question. No one here thinks we're likely to find ourselves in that situation, but it's always better to be prepared just in case.
Natural gas is the major source for the production of electrical energy in South Central Alaska. So a serious reduction or cessation in transporting natural gas to power plants would impact electrical production. The most likely situation would probably occur during an extended winter cold spell. The test arises from a three-level chart. Green is consumption as normal. A condition yellow announcement asked power consumers to lower thermostats and reduce some household activities, such as with dishwashers, clothes washers and dryers, and ovens. Condition red asked for larger reductions of the same type as with yellow. In the past 2 years, voluntary consumer participation has reduced consumption by 3 to 5% during the test period. Sullivan says even that single-digit response could be crucial in a time of reduced supplies. The mayors were asked, with improvement in South Central natural gas supplies and storage taking place, was there still the same sense of urgency with the test as in previous years? Matsu Borough Mayor DeVilbiss responded.
As good as it is that we're starting to see new gas coming online in the inlet, which might help next year, it's very likely that this year could be our most critical year. So I think it's really important to be able to demonstrate that we can cut down our gas consumption and prove that conservation can get us through a low spell in the gas supply.
Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Carey said power consumption concerns for the consumer was more than a once-a-year test.
I believe the urgency is reinforced every month, often more than once, when you open your electric bill, when you open your gas bill.
Participating in tests like the upcoming one could be an effective guide to reducing one's overall usage and bill. Carey had some other tips.
As you arrange the activities of your day, put them in order so that you will use as little energy as possible. In your home, in your business, have power strips so that when you are away, you can stop using energy that does not need to be used at that time. As you buy tools, as you replace your appliances, be sure they have an energy rating that conserves as much as possible how much energy we're going to use.
Once again, this year's voluntary conservation test takes place Wednesday, October 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Delta Greeley School District staff have fired up a new alternative energy heating system at the high school. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the new heating technology will cut fuel costs and burn clean.
District maintenance staff got step-by-step instruction Thursday morning on Delta High School's new $2.8 million biomass boiler system that was built over the summer and connected into the school's existing decades-old heating system. The instructor was Galen Messersmith, the proprietor of a Michigan-based manufacturing firm that designed the 5 million BTU system. Electricians worked on last-minute projects around the new structure as Messersmith explained how the system feeds wood chips onto steel grates inside the burner box.
If you you look in there, you see the first row of grates. You want it down on that row of grates.
The matchbook-sized wood chips are processed by a local lumber mill from the slabs trimmed off the sides of logs. That's perfect fuel for a wood-burning boiler.
This is pretty clean. Oh. Yes, real clean.
Tokes is a more elaborate $4.5 million system that includes a chipping plant that processes black spruce and other scrubby vegetation that's been cut around the area as part of the State Division of Forestry's fuel thinning operations, which are intended to reduce the spread of wildfires. The biomass boilers didn't cost the Toke and Delta districts any money because they were funded through grants from the Alaska Energy Authority's Renewable Energy Fund, along with additional appropriations from the legislature. Administrators in the Copper Valley School District in Glen Allen also have applied for a $1.2 million grant from the AEA. After about an hour of walking the Delta District staff through the startup process, Messersmith was finally ready to fire the boiler. Using controls on a computerized panel, he cranked up the draft fan. That enables the fire to burn hot, and that, along with particulate scrubbers built into the 65-foot stacks, clean almost all emissions from the smoke.
Now it's pulling air through that hole. We'll start the fire.
Messersmith ignited the tinder stuck into a rear access hatch, and the strong draft created by the fan drew the flames onto the pile of chips inside. Within about a minute, the chips in the firebox turned into an inferno. See the orange glow inside of the plate glass there.
Oh, that's impressive.
Cool.
District Maintenance and Operations Supervisor Mark Morgan suggested we take a look to see what kind of smoke was coming out of the stack.
Let's see if I can see smoke.
Well, evidently when it first started up, yeah, you can see a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if that's smoke or steam.
Mm-hmm, ever so slight.
Yeah, but that's pretty good when you figure it's just now started up and fired. That's before you get the most smoke out of anything. Mm-hmm. So you know, to have that little on fire up is pretty good.
A few minutes later, in the quieter confines of his office, District Superintendent Duncan Ware says negligible emissions is an important benefit, but the big payoff will be how much money the system will enable the district to save by heating with wood chips at $60 a ton instead of fuel oil at $4 a gallon.
There will be a cost savings. We don't know at this point what that cost savings will be, so I'm ready for those numbers to start rolling in.
Toke school officials have estimated savings of about $30,000 annually. Ware says whatever savings do occur will go to a much more important purpose, helping educate kids.
Any money we save on energy is money that can roll back into the classroom.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at NMSUSA.com.
And by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
This summer marked 100 years of operation for the Larsen Bay Cannery. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has this history of the century-old fish processing plant.
In 1911, the Alaska Packers Association moved its prominent cannery operations from the village of Karlik to the sheltered inlet at Larsen Bay. According to the book Salmon from Kodiak, written by Patricia Rappel, the move was due to the lack of a harbor in Karlik and the frequent shipwrecks in the shallow and rocky waters. Many workers and owners have come and gone in Larsen Bay since then, but 100 years later, the cannery continues to operate on a small spit between Uyak and Larsen Bay. Clyda Christensen is almost as old as the cannery. At 91 years old, she still lives in Larsen Bay and remembers what it was like to work at the cannery in the 1930s.
There was a bunch of women from Karlik that used to come up here and work for Alaska Packers. Last time I worked down there for Alaska Packers was 1937.
In the early decades of the cannery, ships from San Francisco would bring dozens of immigrants to work during the busy summer months.
Oh, they had a building on my side where I could see. They used to call that building that they tore down was Chinatown. Years ago, I guess, when Alaska Packers used to bring Chinese and Filipinos and those two nationalities, I think they used to bring mostly.
Alan Beardsley and his family owned a SetNet site in the bay during the 1980s. Beardsley eventually went on to own the cannery during the 80s and 90s.
What happened is in about 1980 or so, I was in the grocery business and rented a space dockside for a grocery store from the cannery, and also had a SetNet permit and SetNetted out of Larsen Bay, and eventually became aware of the trouble, some of the troubles the cannery was having, and volunteered to maybe assist them and became involved with the management of a new company.
The company was called Kodiak Salmon Packers, and Beardsley owned it for about 20 years. Beardsley, like Christensen, said the cannery has seen some changes.
When we took over, we made a couple changes. It was fairly, they used to unload the fish with conveyor belts, and we switched to pumps, and they used to take the fish waste out to sea on a barge, and we quickly put a grinder in, and we put freezers in, and so there have been changes made to that plant, obviously, and the current owner, Icicle Seafoods, who's a wonderful custodian of the place, has made changes since, but basically, you're catching fish in the wild with either set net or seine, and that hasn't changed dramatically other than, horsepower and some of the other equipment they use. But it's still, you have to catch the fish as they're swimming by.
Icicle Seafoods continues to operate the current cannery. As fish processing operations in Larsen Bay begin a second century, Beardsley said it is most definitely the place to bring your fish if you're a Westside fisherman.
It's in the right spot. I mean, there's no doubt that the proximity of the fish is the reason it's there, in addition to the water source, the harbor, and the village, too.
Beardsley hasn't been to the village in about 4 years, but said his brother continues to operate a family SetNet site in the bay. I'm Brianna Gibbs.
Highways now wind through a large section of Alaska, but before they were built, hardy pioneers and sourdoughs forged through snowdrifts and over river ice by horse-drawn sleigh and foot. The systems of roadhouses that once provided these travelers with shelter, food, and warm drinks have been unceremoniously replaced by gas stations and RV parks. But on the Richardson Highway, one couple, Annie and Mike Hopper, has restored one of the few remaining Alaska roadhouses and built a new year-round lodge above it. Diana Saverin has the story.
The Richardson Highway stretches for miles in either direction of Isabel Pass, mountains from the Alaska Range rising on one side and their foothills on the other. There's not much along the road, particularly for one 80-mile stretch between Delta Junction and Paxson. For years, one of the few exceptions was a structure, a rundown roadhouse, chock full of trash, and at first glance, looking itself like a piece of trash. But Annie and Mike Hopper wanted it.
The original plan was to bulldoze that sucker. It looked like it was...
I threw myself in front of the bulldozer, though.
Pretty much.
In the 1920s, motorized vehicles began to travel between the interior and coast, and the necessity of roadhouses faded. While many continued to stay open, most fell apart or burned sometime in the 20th century. Today, Black Rapids is the last standing in its original location, continuing to offer the comforts of civilization after 40 miles of nothing in either direction.
They fondly nicknamed this whole corridor as the Adventure Corridor
because there's such access to the mountains. The Wrangell St. Elias, people are traveling more and more there. They're wanting more of real Alaska.
When Annie and Michael bought the land, they began two projects, restoring the old roadhouse and creating something new along the route, the Black Rapids Lodge. The isolation of the spot provided challenges with construction and restoration.
We've had blizzards and floods and you name it, and have also survived that.
After 10 years, initially just working through the few months of summer, and for several years, Michael working alone through the winters, they opened the doors of their lodge to guests 3 summers ago. While the needs of visitors are less basic than the weary travelers of 100 years ago, they still have a mission to serve Alaskans in a way they think no one else is.
When we started building, when we designed it, the thing that Alaska was missing from my experience here 27 years is there wasn't any winter lodges for locals, at least in the interior, besides Chain Hot Springs. But I mean, winter lodge meaning the mountains is for me. That's what my vision of Alaska when I came here is big mountains, big storms, big snows, you know. It makes this country just accessible to people. People are intimidated by it. And that's where we saw the lodges. A base of operation for people to be able to come down and experience the place. And that's what we're getting. We're getting a lot of people who really love this area. We're not the only ones who are touched by this Isabel Pass.
Once an obstacle to the journey, the ruggedness of the landscape is cause for the journey their visitors make. And as they share this special place with 21st century Alaskans, they show it to them in a little bit of a different style. John A. Clark, a visitor to the lodge in 1906, described the roadhouse's charms. Small, poorly ventilated, none too clean, beds of the softness of granite, meals fair, but it was a paradise. These days, visitors still relax in the lodge, but with arguably higher standards than Clark.
Two that overlook the mountains, tucked in the back of the woods.
Between a warm fire and windows looking out at the Alaska Range, with the old roadhouse in the foreground, guests sip wine and often enjoy live music performances. As they do, they're creating a new chapter for this spot on the Richardson Highway, a new Valdez Fairbanks Trail, which gives Alaskans a chance to trek into the rugged terrain instead of through it. For APRN, I'm Diana Savran, with help from Jonathan Christ Tompkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, and Diana Savran on the Richardson Highway. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.